If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
As I'm sure you already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, and we're pleased to bring you a very special offer. Subscribe to BBC History Magazine today, and you can choose a book worth up to £30. Choose from either Queens of the Crusades by Alison Weir, The Children of Ash and Elm by Neil Price, Agent Sonia by Ben McIntyre, or The Story of China by Michael Wood. Not only that, you'll also get every issue of BBC History Magazine delivered direct to your door, all from just £22.45. To take advantage of this fantastic offer, visit our official online store at buysubscriptions.com/historybook. This promotion is only available for UK residents and while stocks last. You'll receive your book within 28 days of ordering. Welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In September 1960, Fidel Castro arrived in New York for the opening of the UN General Assembly. Simon Hall tells the story of this momentous visit in his new book, 10 Days in Harlem, Fidel Castro and the Making of the 1960s. And that's the subject of today's conversation. Putting the questions to Simon was our deputy editor, Matt Elton.
Your new book's called 10 Days in Harlem and charts an extraordinary 10-day period in 1960. Can you just talk very succinctly to start with, I suppose, through what happened and why it had such a huge impact?
Yeah, so the book is set around Fidel Castro's visit to New York in September of 1960. And he's going to New York for the opening of the General Assembly of the United Nations, the 15th General Assembly, which is a kind of huge kind of diplomatic set piece of the early post-war period, the mid-20th century. And you know, everybody is going to the UN General Assembly that year. So Eisenhower is speaking, Harold Macmillan is speaking, Nikita Khrushchev is going, Nehru's going, NASA's going. And it's taking place at a huge moment in the big moment in world history, because something like 14 newly independent African nations are also joining the United Nations in this at the start of this General Assembly. So it's kind of a big moment. And Fidel flies in. He spends about 24 hours in a slightly upmarket midtown hotel in Manhattan, has a big row with the owner, storms out, ends up relocating his delegation to the Hotel Teresa in Harlem. And then he basically holds court there for the next 10 days, meeting a whole array of high-profile guests and kind of doing everything he can to annoy his American hosts and kind of steal the show, basically. So that's the core story of the book.
And as you sketch in the book, this is an extraordinary political period all around the world for many different reasons. This is a ridiculous question. What's the geopolitical situation in which this episode unfolds? What are the main tensions?
Yeah, so I think there are two main things which are kind of coming together in the autumn of 1960. The first big thing is the Cold War and the contest between the Soviet Union and its allies and the United States and its allies for the kind of hearts and minds of the rest of the world, basically, and the kind of competition between those two blocks, and tensions between Washington and Moscow are in a bad place. They're getting worse in the autumn of 1960. There'd been a bit of a thaw the year before. Khrushchev had gone to the United States, had kind of toured around everywhere, had visited New York, had had a very kind of cordial meeting with Eisenhower at Camp David. There'd been real hopes that there might be a kind of the beginnings of some kind of détente between the two Cold War powers. And then in the spring of 1960, Gary Powers and his U-2 spy plane had been shot down over Russia, and this had sparked a massive deterioration in relations. So the Cold War tensions are at something of a high. And then at the same time, you have the kind of rapid and sometimes chaotic end of European empire in Africa. And the backdrop for that is essentially a crisis in the Congo in the spring and summer of and the early autumn of 1960. At the same time as you have a whole bunch of newly independent countries emerging, and their allegiance is sort of up for grabs. So you have these two things coming together, I suppose, the Cold War rivalry between America and the Soviet Union, and a kind of growing force, if you like, of newly independent countries from the global south, from particularly from Africa, who are sort of up for grabs, I suppose. They haven't fallen into one camp or the other, and there's an attempt by both America and Russia to kind of win them over. And so all this is sort of playing out at the United Nations that autumn.
And just to fill in the kind of final bit of the background, what was the situation for Castro in his political career at the point at which this book opens?
Yeah, so he had taken power in Cuba in January of 1959, following a long kind of guerrilla war campaign. He'd arrived back in Cuba in November of, I think end of November 1956, where he'd launched his sort of insurgency against Batista. His forces had eventually triumphed. They'd overthrown Batista in January of 1959. And he very quickly set about establishing a genuinely revolutionary government in Cuba. And in part because of the economic policies that Castro was implementing, which involved expropriating quite a lot of American-owned businesses or nationalizing them, tensions with the United States had kind of ratcheted up through the early part of 1960. So by the time Fidel arrives in New York in mid-September, he's really not very welcome. He traveled to the United States in the spring of 1959, just a few months into his after taking power, and he'd been greeted by huge crowds all over the place, and was it'd been a big PR success. But by the time we get to the autumn of 1960, he's much less popular, and the tensions between his government and Washington are really getting quite things are getting quite bad.
I mean, how does one get invited to the UN General Assembly? Is it something that happens automatically? Did he push for it? I mean, I don't know the mechanics of that.
So I mean, every member state has the right to speak at the General Assembly, and usually it's the head of the government. Fidel Castro is the Prime Minister of Cuba. Technically, he's not the head of the government. The president of Cuba would have the right to speak, or the head of the delegation, which is usually the foreign minister. So what Castro does is he temporarily appoints himself head of the Cuban delegation to give him the automatic right to speak. And actually the same is true of Nikita Khrushchev, who is neither the head of state of the Soviet Union nor the head of the government although he is the de facto leader. So he also appoints himself head of the Soviet delegation to give himself the right to speak. And because of the treaty that the United States signed when it agreed to host the United Nations, it's obliged to allow entry to people even if it doesn't want to. And it definitely would much prefer that neither Khrushchev nor Castro were in New York. And the State Department makes it very clear that these guys are not official guests of the United States. They are there for the United Nations General Assembly.
To what extent did Castro go into this deliberately setting out to be disruptive or to make his mark? Was it an intention from the very start of this plan?
I think it might depend on what we mean by sort of cause trouble or make mischief. I think that he was definitely always planning that he would sort of take the fight, if you like, to the United States, to the so-called Yankee imperialists. But I think his main aim in going to the United Nations and going to New York was to kind of establish his own credentials as a leader of the sort of global anti-imperialist movement on a par with the likes of Nehru and Nasser and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. So it was really about establishing his own kind of credentials on the world stage. I think that was his main motivation. And of course, if that involved kind of tweaking the Americans' tail and provoking them a bit, then that was all kind of well and good. But I don't think he went deliberately to kind of create a lot of animosity. I think he went to establish his own credentials, really, and use the United Nations as a platform to promote the Cuban Revolution and to promote its wider kind of global ambitions, I suppose, to help take the fight to the imperialists.
And as you mentioned, he met with a whole range of people during the time he was there. Who did he meet with, and what kind of form did those meetings take?
Yeah, so, I mean, Fidel spends, as I said, he spends about a day in this fancy hotel in Midtown, the Shelbourne Hotel, before having a falling out with its owner, Edward Spatz, over an additional security deposit. There are all these wild rumours that fly around the Castro delegation the whole time they're in New York. And one of the early ones is that they're plucking and cooking chickens in their hotel room. And anyway, Spatz asks for an additional security deposit. Castro storms out in a huff, goes off to the United Nations, threatens to sleep in the Rose Garden, and then ends up in the Hotel Teresa in the heart of Harlem. And his very first guest, late on the night of the 19th of September, was Malcolm X. And there's some great photographs of this meeting that take place in Fidel's hotel suite with Malcolm. And they get on really well. They kind of a lot of laughing and smiling, and it's like a really great meeting. And that sort of sets the tone for the rest of the trip. So a whole group of people basically make their own pilgrimage up to Harlem to meet with Fidel in the Hotel Teresa. So the next day, Nikita Khrushchev goes. Nehru also goes up to the Teresa, and so does Nasser. So those are the most high-profile kind of international statesmen that go visit. And then on the evening of the 22nd, Thursday the 22nd of September, there's a big kind of gala reception held in the ballroom of the Teresa, to which there are about something like 250 guests invited. And they include, the kind of great and good of Harlem itself, as well as icons of the African-American freedom struggle like Robert F. Williams, leading kind of leftist intellectuals like C. Wright Mills, the beat poet Allen Ginsberg is there, the British theatre critic Kenneth Tynan is there, the Magnum photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson is there. So there's a whole kind of range of people from the worlds of politics, culture, the arts, who are kind of keen to be seen with Fidel, to kind of have their picture taken with him, get his autograph. It's a kind of a great sort of occasion for everybody who's there, really.
Mm. And it's as big a cultural moment, it sounds, as it is a political one. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a whole sort of style to the to Fidel's trip, really, which has this slightly anarchic and kind of beatnik quality to it. So that, you know, the Cubans are all, you know, they're always in their drab olive battle fatigues. Most of the meetings they have seem to take place late at night. So there's all these late night press conferences on the street outside the hotel, or late night meetings in the hotel itself. And really the sort of contrast between that kind of anarchic, rebellious kind of aesthetic to the Cubans against the kind of very formal and rather staid kind of approach of the Eisenhower administration is a real contrast. And I think you see in that kind of clash the sort of the difference between the 1950s and the 1960s. It's a kind of a symbolic shift to a kind of a new type of politics that's going to become kind of increasingly prominent and increasingly sort of prevalent during the 1960s as a kind of an era, I suppose.
And this was a definite pivotal moment in that shift.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a key moment. It's an iconic moment. I think particularly that reception at the ballroom of the Hotel Teresa, because you know, at the end of the 1960s, the journalist Tom Wolfe came up with this idea of sort of radical chic, and he sort of poked fun at the kind of left liberal literati who were kind of fawning over the Black Panthers and kind of heroising the Viet Cong. And this is a sort of an early sign of that kind of politics. So I think it does mark a kind of a shift, for sure.
Hmm. You mentioned the Black Panthers there. How important were these meetings and this trip in highlighting or bringing to the surface, I suppose, racial tensions in the US?
It was a very sort of effective... I don't want to say it was a ploy, because I don't think it was necessarily pre-planned, but by moving his delegation to the Hotel Teresa, which is in the very heart of Harlem, it's on 7th Avenue and 125th Street. It's just around the corner from the famous African-American bookstore, the African Memorial Bookstore, and Harlem Square, which is kind of it's the place where all the kind of the street orators hang out, and it's kind of the political heart of Harlem. But by moving there, which is an area of New York City which is usually kind of kept hidden from the wider world, but Fidel draws international attention to the African-American issue, if you like, in the United States, draws attention to the problems of the urban north in particular. So it's not just that he draws attention to the problems of poverty and racial discrimination in the United States, it's that this is racial discrimination, poverty, police brutality, which is taking place in New York City, America's most famous, most important city, a city which is seen as a kind of a bastion of mid-century American liberalism. And, you know, during the Cold War, late 50s, early 60s, the response of the American government to its race problem internationally, because, you know, Moscow and the Soviet Union are all over this, right? Every time there's an incident of racial discrimination, they're using it as propaganda to attack America's leadership of the so-called free world. The response from the State Department is to say, you know, racism is largely a Southern problem for historic reasons due to slavery, the legacy of slavery, and it's in the process of being, the problem is in the process of being solved through, you know, court cases and government initiatives in keeping with our democratic constitutional form of government. But what Fidel's move to Harlem does is kind of discredit that. It says, look, racial discrimination is alive and well, not just in the South, but in the urban North. It's not just a Southern problem, it's a national problem. And Fidel is hugely popular in Harlem, partly just because he's gone there and has shown that he's happy to stay in Harlem, a place where most world leaders wouldn't, you know, even dare to venture into. But also because shortly after coming to power in Cuba, he'd committed his government to eradicating racial discrimination, and they'd passed a whole flurry of laws eliminating segregation on private beaches, on in social clubs, in restaurants, and things like that. And this was a huge kind of contrast with the approach taken in America by the Eisenhower administration, which was much more cautious and gradualist and much less bold in its approach. So, you know, Fidel is basically saying we're going to get rid of segregation almost overnight. And Eisenhower is saying, you know, yeah, I agree with the premise of racial equality, but you have to be patient. We have to do these things slowly and carefully. So Fidel is kind of is almost guaranteed a good reception in Harlem because of his very strong commitment to racial equality.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And Nasser is always, you know, immaculately dressed. He's always impeccably turned out, and he's just sort of horrified by the general shambolic situation in which the meeting takes place. But he's also offended because he presents Fidel with a wonderful silver tea service as a gift, and Fidel can't contain his disappointment at not being given a crocodile.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/History Extra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
One of the fascinating things about the book, for me, is how it reveals politics to some extent to be about the interplay between people and about the relationships, the kind of natural relationships that the people have with each other. Or were there certain people that Castro connected with, or that you think their relationship particularly had an impact politically?
Yeah, so I mean, he definitely got on well with Malcolm, and Malcolm X definitely got on well with Fidel. I think Malcolm was later reported to have said that Fidel was the only white person that he ever really liked. So they get on really well, and you can tell from the photographs that they're kind of having a bit of a blast when they meet. The other figure that Fidel gets on really well with is Khrushchev. Their first meeting on the 20th of September doesn't last very long; lasts about 30 minutes. But when they emerge out of the Hotel Teresa onto the sidewalk, you know, they're kind of beaming, they're kind of backslapping. They have a very awkward, because of their physical differences. Fidel is very tall and very slim, and Khrushchev isn't. Their sort of embrace on the sidewalk is slightly awkward, but it's kind of heartfelt. Later that day, when Fidel goes to the General Assembly, Khrushchev is keen to jump out of his seat, rush over, and kind of greet him effusively again. Even a few days later, when Fidel is invited to dinner at the Soviet mission on Park Avenue and arrives 45 minutes late, Khrushchev is very quick to put him at ease and say it doesn't matter, and he's very keen to kind of josh with him throughout the evening. So the personal chemistry between those two figures is really good. And I think that's obviously really important, because ultimately the relationship between Cuba and the Soviet Union is going to be one of those key relationships that helps shape the Cold War through the next 10, 20, 30 years, really.
We should talk about the speech itself, which by all accounts sounds remarkable. What unfolded, and what did Castro cover in the speech?
Well, we covered almost everything. It lasted for 4.5 hours, which is still a record. Hopefully, it will never be broken. At the time, one journalist quipped that he covered everything except the recent dispute between Britain and Iceland over the annual sardine harvest. So he really covered everything. It was a long tirade against American mistreatment of Cuba over 50, 60 years. So there was a long, that was a long sort of prelude to his main remarks. His main target in the speech was imperialism, was colonialism. And I think probably the most important thing that he said in the speech in that 4.5 hours was he said something along the lines of, you know, it's really easy to raise a flag, to have a new coat of arms, to sing a national anthem and declare independence. But unless you're able to exercise economic independence, you won't really have true sovereignty. And I think that for Castro, that was a key thing about what his revolution in Cuba was about. It was about the ability to dictate economic policy for itself rather than have it dictated to by American, the big American sugar corporations, for example. But it was also said with an eye on what was happening in the Congo, where Belgian mining interests were collaborating with the former colonial power to undermine the new government of Patrice Lumumba. It was a question that was very kind of apposite and relevant for his own Latin America more widely, as well as all these newly independent countries across Africa and Asia. So it was a speech in which he sought to place Cuba and the Cuban Revolution very clearly on the side of the underdog, the oppressed, the people of the global South more widely, and to really target imperialism as the main kind of impediment to the ability of those nations and those peoples to enjoy meaningful freedom. So I've tried to summarise it there quite briefly, definitely not in 4.5 hours, but yeah, it was a very, very long speech.
Yeah. What was the reaction?
I think obviously to listen to a 4.5 hour speech in translation in an increasingly warm General Assembly hall was quite difficult. So a lot of people drifted out or even drifted off. I think the length of the speech made it very easy for people to dismiss it as a tirade. But what's interesting about it is that if you look at some of the confidential reports written by American and British diplomats about the speech in the days and weeks after it, you know, what they say is basically, yeah, he went on for too long, and you know, it took far too long for him to speak. But actually, when a lot of what he said did resonate, particularly with his fellow Latin American leaders, and that when people reflected on it, they did think that he made some good points. So I think the reaction is twofold. It's in the immediate aftermath, it's kind of dismissed as just a long rant. But in private and behind the scenes, I think that the substance of his message is seen as having having resonated and having been kind of important, I suppose.
Hmm. It sounds like relationships with America were already a bit fraught before this visit. Did this speech and this visit make things worse with America?
Yeah, it definitely made things worse. As you say, things were already fraught, tense. The relationship was already deteriorating quite badly. And I think it was in the spring of 1960, the Eisenhower administration had started to draw up a secret plan to replace the Castro administration. So they were already beginning to think that it wouldn't be possible to work out a kind of a way of working with the Castro regime in Cuba. But this kind of really cements that belief that Castro has to go. And so in the weeks after Fidel returns to Cuba, the Eisenhower administration kind of steps up its planning for what will eventually become the Bay of Pigs attempted invasion in the spring of 1961 under the new president, John F. Kennedy. So You know, the sort of trajectory of relations are already heading, you know, downwards, I suppose. What this trip does is it really confirms, I think, on both sides that there can't be any real way of figuring out a modus vivendi, a way of kind of rubbing along together in a way that kind of works.
Mm. And how about with Russia?
Yeah, so again, the sort of trajectory has been set a little bit earlier in the year. Khrushchev's main kind of international troubleshooter, a guy called Anastas Mikoyan, visited Cuba in February of 1960 and signed a kind of landmark trade deal with the Cubans. So relations between those two countries were already starting to warm up. The fact that Fidel and Khrushchev get on so well in New York, I think, kind of sets the seal on that. One of Fidel's close advisors, who's in New York with him and attends the dinner at the Soviet mission, says that at the end of that dinner, the kind of the romance between the Cubans and the Soviets had begun. So it kind of sets the seal on that relationship, which is going to just get closer and closer over the coming months.
Hmm. Are there any other characters or encounters, I suppose, that we've not talked about that happened during this period?
I mean, there are a couple. I think so. He meets with Nasser at the Teresa, and that's a meeting that, you know, if the meeting with Khrushchev had gone really well, the meeting with Nasser is a bit less convivial, but partly because Nasser is so appalled by the sort of terrible state of the of the suite in which Fidel is staying. It's totally, I mean, Fidel is a very messy person, and the suite is just a bit of a pigsty, really. And Nasser is always, you know, immaculately dressed. He's always impeccably turned out, and he's just sort of horrified by the general sort of shambolic situation in which the meeting takes place. But he's also offended because he presents Fidel with a wonderful silver tea service as a gift, and Fidel can't contain his disappointment at not being given a crocodile. And Nasser is kind of, he can't really believe it. He's like, crocodile, there are only four crocodiles in Egypt and they're all in the zoo. And anyway, in the days after this meeting, he's often can be heard muttering to himself about this sort of crocodile incident. Another meeting that maybe doesn't go quite so well is Fidel is a huge admirer of Kwame Nkrumah, the prime minister, or at this point the president of Ghana, the former British colony of the Gold Coast. And the independence of Ghana in 1957 is a key moment in 20th century history, because it's the first surrender of colonial power in sub-Saharan Africa. And it makes Nkrumah a kind of a real icon of the anti-colonial movement. And Fidel is very keen to meet with Nkrumah, and he goes to the Ghanaian mission to meet with Nkrumah and to kind of pay his respects. I think the meeting is a bit tense because Nkrumah had lived in the United States for about 10 years in the 1930s, and he'd spent almost every summer in Harlem. So Harlem was kind of his turf, his patch. And I think Fidel moving to the Hotel Teresa in Harlem had kind of stolen a bit of Kwame Nkrumah's thunder. So I think he was a bit put out by that. So that meeting is perfectly cordial, but there's a slight sense, I think, that Nkrumah is a little bit put out by Fidel's own kind of taking the spotlight in Harlem. The other meeting, which I really like, is again, it's at that reception on September the 22nd in the Teresa, and it's when Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet, goes up to Fidel, shakes him by the hand and says, "When are you going to legalize marijuana?" And this is the only point in the entire trip when Fidel is speechless. And it's quite a feat to render Fidel Castro speechless. And he really doesn't know what to say, and kind of, you know, is a bit sort of startled and dumbfounded by it before eventually recovering his poise and saying something like, you know, "We're not going to do anything that undermines the important work of building our revolution." But I think that would have been a great moment to witness firsthand. I think that would have been a great, quite a funny moment.
To what extent does this period represent, I suppose, a microcosm or maybe a catalyst for sort of wider global trends that would then go on to unfold in the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that I was attracted to this story and wanted to write about this kind of 10-day period. But it's partly because it brings in, or enable me to draw in and to discuss some kind of big historical questions and themes and developments. So, you know, the growing tensions between the between the United States and Cuba, the growing friendliness between Cuba and the Soviet Union, the kind of wider shift in the Cold War to the so-called Global South, to Latin America, Africa, and Asia, to talk about the ways in which decolonization was playing out within that Cold War context, and also to talk about more broadly the sort of emergence of the 60s as a historical era, right? The emergence of the kind of new left and the black freedom struggle and the counterculture. And so I think these 10 days are kind of a microcosm of those things. All these things are happening. They're coming together in Harlem, in the Hotel Teresa, in the events that surround all this sort of hoopla that surrounds the Cuban delegation. But they also serve as a catalyst to kind of accelerate some of those trends as well. So I think that was a key part of why I thought it wouldn't just be kind of a lot of fun to write about these 10 days, but that it was of some historical importance and consequence as well.
Is it too much to say that these 10 days are the source from which the 60s flowed, if that makes any sense?
No, I don't think it's necessarily too much to say that. I think they are a foundational moment in the creation of the 1960s. Partly because of the aesthetic of the trip, the style of the trip, this kind of anarchic, rip it up quality that it has, which I think is a sort of an augur of what's going to happen throughout the decade. So no, I don't think it's going too far to say that they're a kind of a key moment in kind of creating what we think of as the 60s, this kind of era of rebelliousness and radical politics and anti-imperialism and kind of cultural experimentation. I think that they're kind of a foundational moment in the creation of that whole notion of the 60s.
And this sounds kind of ridiculous given that the Cold War was going on, but I think what it really brought home to me is how globally interconnected things were in a truly global way, that perhaps I tend to think of the Cold War in terms of just two nations competing, if you like.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think that the key thing, one of the key things about the Cold War is that it increasingly ends up being fought partly by proxy in all these other parts of the world, in parts of the world which have recently undergone or are in the process of undergoing decolonization. And in one of the interesting things about the autumn of 1960 is that there is, at that particular point in global history, I think a real hope, a real belief that these newly independent nations can form a kind of a really key block, a sort of a third block, if you like, that can challenge the Cold War rivalry between Moscow and Washington, and can maybe operate together to kind of intervene to try to either recalibrate that Cold War tension or to reduce it.
We're obviously 60 years on now. To what extent does this period still shape the world of today, do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a hard question to answer, because a lot of the things I talk about in the book, well, some of the things I talk about in the book no longer seem so important. So the United Nations and its General Assembly, I mean, every year when the General Assembly opens, it makes it onto the news. I think last year Donald Trump's speech made it onto the news because it's Donald Trump, right? So whatever he says gets onto the news. But I think the idea that the UN General Assembly matters seems quite foreign to us now, because the UN itself is seen as much less effective and is sort of struggling to find a meaningful role. I think also you look back at 1960, I mean, you've got all these kind of political giants who are there, you know, Eisenhower, Nehru, Nasser, Fidel, Khrushchev. I think we're, you know, hard pressed to find people of that caliber at the moment. So again, it seems like quite a contrast. On the other hand, you know, all the stuff that Fidel is exposing in Harlem and his meeting with Malcolm X is drawing attention to around racial discrimination, poverty, and particularly police brutality are things which are highly resonant in our current historical moment. I think where the difference is that in 1960 there is some optimism that the United Nations might be the way of solving problems and working together. And right now, I think all of these multilateral institutions are struggling in the face of kind of a resurgent populism and nationalism and a sense of it sort of every country for itself, really.
That was Simon Hall. His book, 10 Days in Harlem, Fidel Castro and the Making of the 1960s, is on sale now, published by Faber and Faber. Thanks for listening. This podcast is produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman.